This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
Well, welcome along to The Conversation Hour. It is, it's Justin Smith filling in for Rochelle Hunt, who will be back on your radio tomorrow. Coming up in a moment, supervised self-driving cars. Trying to put bundle those words together and it sounds a little frightening, but we'll burrow down into it in a moment with an expert. I do have a question for you, though, that we will roll through The Conversation Hour. It has been, believe it or not, it's been 50 years since the release of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a giant of a song. It's one of the big songs. It's the Bat Out of Hell is a big song, Stairway to Heaven, but this is right up there. Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, which is from their fourth studio album, released 50 years ago, and Freddie Mercury once called it a mock opera, is how he had described it. And for years, people had looked at the strange lyrics and really wondered what the hell the song was all about. And, of course, at one point, Freddie Mercury himself, who passed away in 1991, but he was asked himself what the meaning of the song was. This is what he said.
I hate, to be honest, in the end, even in interviews or even in sort of any kind of chat shows or whatever, I hate actually trying to analyse my songs to the full. It's like people still ask me what Bohemian Rhapsody is about, and I say, I don't know. Because I think it loses the myth, and it actually ruins a kind of imagination or whatever, or something that people have built up. And I will say as much as I can about certain songs I write, but in the end, I don't like to analyze it, because I don't analyze songs myself.
So there you go. He said in there that, and you get a hint that he did kind of know, but he didn't want to say what it was. But Freddie Mercury said he didn't know what the song was about. So most people don't know what the song is about. They just know that, for many people, that they like it and that it's one of the greatest songs ever written. It is for people who like to burrow down into the way music is put together, it is musical genius, the way it flows from that operatic feel and flows into out-and-out rock and roll and then back down again and seems to tell a story. It's an incredible piece of work, and it is still loved after all these years. It has been made fun of in films. It has been used for flash mobs. It is a giant of a song. But here's the question for you. Is it actually Queen's best song? And if it's not, what is Queen's best song?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
A couple of months ago, the car company Tesla introduced a so-called semi-autonomous driving feature. It's a new upgrade here in Australia. They are called supervised self-driving, which kind of sounds reasonably sci-fi. But what does it really mean? And how safe is it? I mean, and will it actually make the roads safer? Angus McCurrell is the research fellow in psychology at the University of Melbourne. And his research is concerned with the psychology of road safety. And he's on the phone. Angus, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You got a favourite Queen song before we get into the serious business?
Oh, if you took Bohemian Rhapsody off the table, I think We Will Rock You gets to me in a way that I can't explain.
Oh, We Will Rock You. All right, we'll give you a little bit of that right at the end of this interview.
No worries.
Thanks very much for your time. What is supervised self-driving?
Yeah, the title itself takes a bit of unpacking, because I think it's a bit of a contradiction in its own right, because the module that's been released by Tesla that people who own those cars and if they have an applicable model can now buy is called full self-driving with brackets supervised at the end. And I think that supervised is doing a lot of work in that title. So What we're talking about is a feature that effectively takes over all the sorts of components of the driving task. So that's, you know, steering and acceleration and braking, but also a lot of those other features that we would normally consider the driver's responsibility, even things like taking off the line at a red light when it changes to green, or changing lanes around other vehicles as space becomes available. So automating all of those features to some extent. But the supervised component means that there still has to be a driver sitting behind the wheel who still has to be attentive and ready when something might go wrong.
Okay, so you're and sorry to sort of dumb this down for my own benefit, Angus, but
no,
you need to sit behind the wheel, but you're not touching the wheel. Your foot's not on the accelerator, so you're not driving the car. You are just, as the word suggests, you're just supervising.
You're sitting in the passenger seat. So you've gone from an active role to a passive role. And unfortunately, a lot of the research that we've done at the university, but also, you know, around the world, there's been a whole corpus of research around partially and semi-automated systems, conditionally automated systems that have people change in the role that they're required to do. And what we show is that people fundamentally aren't very good at this. And that's not to blame people sitting behind the wheel, but there is... The way we are wired is such that we are very good at doing quite complex tasks. So when you talk about driving itself, the ability to steer a heavy vehicle at really high speeds and be taking in lots of information around you and do that safely is a really challenging cognitive task. And when you put someone behind the wheel and they're not doing anything, people tend to switch off.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard enough to get people off their phones when they've got to steer the thing. So if they don't have to steer anymore, you could imagine that you'd be lucky to get them to look up once. It's a big change, isn't it?
Well, and the part of the problem is that even if they are looking up, even if someone's doing everything within their effort to pay attention and try to monitor what's going on, what we see is that it doesn't really matter as much. You do see that degradation. So we talk about someone's situation awareness, kind of the extent to which they're aware of, you know, what other cars are around them on the road, or who's coming up on a side street, or if there's a cyclist that's about to come past them. That awareness really drops off quite quickly once someone's not actively involved anymore.
Is it going to make the, when it all sort of settles down and it becomes more the norm, is it going to make the roads safer?
I mean, that's the goal. We wouldn't be pursuing a lot of this if it wasn't for the fact that there is potentially a safety benefit down the line. I think if you talk and look to a lot of the marketing that, you know, a lot of the big manufacturers that are working in this space are putting out, they will give you comparisons of safety and crash rate differences. Unfortunately, those are often marketing statistics as opposed to the sort of data that we get from, say, government agencies that are collecting crash stats and disengagements. And so we hope that in the long term there will be a safety benefit, but that doesn't mean that they don't currently come with a lot of risks as well.
We're talking to Angus McCurrell, who is a research fellow in psychology at the University of Melbourne, and his research is concerned with the psychology of road safety. And we're talking about supervised self-driving cars, and we thank him for his time. Angus, I'm not sure if you've noticed this, but there are some rubbish drivers on the road.
I've noticed that.
I'm not sure, you know, if you've stepped outside, you know, in the last 10 years, you'd realize. And it does actually seem to be getting worse, whether that's, I don't know, whether that's impatience or whether it's the use of devices. Could it see the end of, and this is the utopia, the end of the rubbish driver?
I mean, that is, like I said, that's the goal, right? There's quite a tech goal of making a driver obsolete. I'm not sure that we're anywhere close to that. And I think that's where I start talking about, you know, marketing from manufacturers, which would have you believe that we are always 2 to 3 years away from making the driver completely obsolete. I remember when I started on this research journey and working in this space close to a decade ago now. And at the time, I remember talking to my supervisor that I was quite concerned that by the time I'd completed my current research project, that all of this would be solved, and she actively laughed in my face, as she was right to do, because we're still just as far away as we were then. So, as I said, the goal is to make things safer and make drivers not have to or not be exposed to the same level of risks. But There is a growing consensus that just ignoring the failings of the driver, or as in this case, you know, having the driver do something they're kind of not able to do or not set up to do well, is really setting people up to fail and more take the blame when something goes wrong.
And Angus, I mean, your line is psychology. This is the direction that you're coming at from. How are people getting their heads around, first of all, being in the car, but one day, probably not that far away, that we will see a car drive past without a person in it, a ride-sharing car going past without a person in it to pick somebody up.
Absolutely.
How are our brains going to sort of compute that?
I mean, we need to put ourselves into different categories about what those vehicles can do and what they do, how they're kind of marked out on the road as well. So, you know, when you drive past another car, whether you're in a car yourself or you're in any other kind of transport, you have a certain set of expectations about how that driver in that car is going to perform and behave, and, you know, you take steps appropriately. So for myself, I often ride a motorcycle, and so we're taught, as I'm told, I think you might as well have your own license.
Yeah.
You'd be very familiar with the process of taking particular levels of caution around cars, sizes.
I thought you were about to say that. Am I familiar with the process of nearly getting hit on a daily basis? The answer is yes.
Act like everyone's out to kill you, I think, is the more cynical line that we've heard. Yep. But you know, that's not true. Most people are out there doing their absolute best, but it is ride like you're invisible is probably a more appropriate way to put it.
You have a lot of faith in the human race, Angus.
I have to, professionally. But we have to have those expectations. And I think when you start talking about a car that is completely driverless, those expectations are and do change. And so we've actually done some research with other vulnerable road user groups, and many of them are actually quite optimistic about the introduction of fully self-driving cars. Yeah. Because they have so many concerning interactions with drivers that fail to see them, that the hope is that there will be a lot of those gaps will be covered by different systems and different perception camera setups and the like.
So. Well, I was thinking about it this morning. I thought, you know, I feel reasonably optimistic that with self-driving cars. I don't have a problem with the day that I might get in, even in the back seat, and say, Siri, take me to wherever. You know, I don't know. I'm not afraid of that. Is that what you're finding with people?
Yeah, and it depends on exposure as well. So there are already places in the world, you know, the US is a great example where they're quite a test bed, partly to do with the way their regulation is set up, that they can do a lot of testing in different jurisdictions around the states. And so we at least have the benefit of being able to look over there and see what's working and what's not. And they very much have driverless vehicles out on the road in certain jurisdictions and certain areas. And I think that's the key thing. No one that is raising issues with these kind of self-driving capacities coming out is saying that the technology should be ignored completely. It's usually that it's being deployed in an inappropriate way or with inappropriate expectations. So having a vehicle that we know it can perform in a specific area and do specific tasks would be fantastic, and probably will be fantastic. But it's when it gets pushed outside of the range of function that you start to introduce risk.
Angus, it's wonderful to talk to you, particularly as you're a fellow biker. And have enormous credibility as such. I thank you very much for your time. Angus is a research fellow in psychology at the University of Melbourne.
Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see.
It's one of the most extraordinary pieces of music you will hear. And I guess it becomes a bit of a cliche because it's been hanging around for 50 years and people make fun of it. But when you actually sit down and listen to the way the song was constructed, it's a hell of a tune, one of the most extraordinary pieces of music for the last 50 years. But we continue this question, though. Is it Queen's best song? And if it isn't, what is? 1-300-222-774. Lee Carriage has been writing about this song and writing about Queen and following them for a long time. Senior lecturer in music at Southern Cross University. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Justin. It is a hell of a song.
There's no other way to put it, is there? What is it for you as a professor of music? What is it for you that really works?
There's not much that doesn't work about it. Look, you know, classically, you know, there's a definition of the word rhapsody, and it says that music It's a kind of music that's ecstatic and that's full of expression, but it can also mean a free instrumental composition with, you know, lots of emotional character. And that's exactly what this anthem of Bohemian Rhapsody is. It's like a 6-minute powerhouse of a song that's innovative in all of its approaches to songwriting.
The as a person who plays guitar, I learnt the solo. Certainly don't play it like Brian May, but I learnt the solo. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you get a real connection to just how intelligent the music was, Lee.
Yeah, look, Freddie's no, you know, he was, you know, very classically trained. The whole band are virtuotic. Freddie took a lot of time. You can tell there's a lot of time taken. And interviews you see with Mercury talk about the years of, you know, working on this piece. And I think this epic song is sort of unrivaled in complexity and form, just in terms of the time. But it's also the lavish production, all of those vocal layerings that Freddie really pushed for in the recording studio and said, I really want them. I want all of these layers and these overdubs. And it, so it has, and yeah, it has complexity. And interesting, if you know Queen, I'm no Queen aficionado. I'm a jazz musician, but I really, again, you have to, and I find you admire everything about Queen because of that. The dexterity, the virtuosity, the time taken in their arranging. But if you listen back to their first album, there's a song on that called first album called My Fairy King, and that you start to hear a little bit of what I think is the early direction that they were taking that harks back, you know, and then forward into Bohemian Rhapsody. So if you listen to that first song, perhaps the listeners are even the Queen of, you know, fans are really aware of My Fairy King. It's interesting that you can view that Queen have done a big, you know, creative step into a different area of their development on Bohemian Rhapsody. But if you listen back, you can go, ah, I can hear where this is stemmed from.
I'm just looking at Ross, who's pressing the buttons today. My Fairy King, do we have? Oh, here we go. He is quick. Yeah, that's got all the Queenie bits in it that you need, Lee, doesn't it? My Fairy King, yeah.
It's got some Queenie bits. I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody's Queenie bits are, you know, Mercury's described it as more of a mock opera, which has that pop ballad beginning and then that vocal operatic kind of slant to it with the multiple harmonies and the operatic sense of the way in which the music and the vocals are presented. And then there's the rock elements and that iconic, like you mentioned, Brian May's iconic solos.
Yes, extraordinary. And what, Lee, most important question, what does it mean?
Oh, what does it mean? Well, I remember an interview when I was writing a book chapter on Freddie, and he says, of course, it can mean whatever. He leaves it to the listener. But my interpretation, and I'm sure the listeners will have their own, I think, firstly, it's a song of a lyric that is about heartbreak and love and loss, but also kind of an inner resilience that you have. And I think it's kind of like it has this narrator who's sort of emotionally spiraling, and they, you know, they lose distinguishing what is reality from what is fantasy. Yeah. And then classically, you know, you might see it as someone who, you know, it's the lament of a man who's murdered someone. That's a very obvious, overt version of the interpretation. And then there's the sequences of, you know, that's the crime, heartbreak to his mother, the kind of operatic part is facing the trial. Then you might see it as members of the court begging to spare him, pleading with him, spare him his life. And then there's a kind of, I don't know, turn of fate where he breaks free and declares to the people, you know, free me. And then it kind of ends with the man who, I don't know, in some ways sees peace at the end of his life and is saying, well, nothing really matters. I agree. I surrender.
That has got to be the most gorgeous putting together of an explanation of a song that I've ever heard. Because Freddie Mercury, who wrote it, didn't even come close to making such an explanation. But what he would love about what you just said is that's your interpretation.
Exactly.
And somebody else would say, oh, no, it's about, you know, a guy with his pet frog. Someone else would come up with something completely different, wouldn't they?
Look, yeah, and Freddie took years to write. He was meticulous with lyrical writing. And if you, you know, if you want to read more into a lyric and more into that, the idea, the identity of the band, you could also look at Freddie's struggles and the stigmatization that he had with, you know, being part of the LGBTQI plus community. But in Britain in the 1970s, I can't imagine what that was like for him.
No.
And so, and then there's a deeper connection to him pulling things out, like, let me think, Galileo, that's one I can think of, you know, Catholic Church, you know, condemned Galileo, I think. And then Freddie includes that lyric because Brian May was really interested in astronomy, and I think he earned a doctorate in astrophysics somewhere along the line. But maybe he threaded all that through, all that stuff that's happening in the barrel.
You're right. It's intelligent. It's intelligent.
It's deeply, deeply informed. It's thoroughly researched. It's beautifully constructed. It's not a throwaway lyric. There's not a line or a word that's not thoughtfully constructed and poignantly used.
Lee, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you very much for the insight. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lee Carriage is the Senior Lecturer in Music, Southern Cross University. Unfortunately, I'll never be able to hear that without thinking of Wayne's World. But what an incredible song it is. We'll go from Queen to Crocs in a moment, because after that footage of the crocodile in a hotel pool in far north Queensland went viral, we've been really curious to know just how humans and crocs coexist in some parts of the world. We'll talk to an expert about that in a moment.
The ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
It's good to be here. Justin Smith filling in for Rochelle Hunt, who's back tomorrow. As a few weeks ago, there was a video of a crocodile in a hotel in Port Douglas, which frightens me because I've been to Port Douglas a few times. I know many people listening right now have. And not only have they been to Port Douglas, they've been in pools in Port Douglas. Well, there was a croc in one, and there was a video of this. So we've since learned that it was a young female that has now been relocated to a nearby wildlife park. So, but thankfully, no one was injured, no one was attacked, and the croc wasn't hurt either. But it did sort of get us to thinking is that in these parts of Australia is how do crocs and humans coexist? Brandon Sidlow has devoted his research to this very thing. He's a PhD student in human saltwater crocodile conflict at Charles Darwin University. Brandon, are you there?
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm wonderful. And look, I love the fact that it's at the Charles Darwin University, as in survival of the fittest.
Right.
So if it is the survival of the fittest between the humans and the crocodiles, who wins?
Well, in the long-term game, the crocodiles, but I don't know about in the short term.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's good. So how do they, if you're in a part of the world where there are crocodiles, and let's cut to the chase here, they like to eat meat and humans are made of meat, how do they survive together?
Well, in a lot of places, you have a lot of conflict, a lot of people getting attacked. Here in Australia, we actually do not have that problem. Attacks are relatively rare, especially fatalities. Fatalities are really rare here, especially when compared to areas very close to here, such as Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and parts of Malaysia, places like that.
And
attacks
what
are much more frequent. And then, of course, in sub-Saharan Africa with the Nile crocodile, you have a lot of problems, too.
Why is that, Brandon? Why do we have fewer fatalities here?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, we have good management, we have good education, but really more than anything, the biggest factor, because I do most of my work is abroad because that's where the problems are. And the big thing I've noticed is it's poverty. And it's the kind of poverty where people don't have access to plumbing. They don't have access to big croc-safe boats. So they're in the rivers bathing because they have to. They don't have plumbing in their houses. So they bathe in the rivers. They wash their clothes in the rivers. They fish in the rivers, you know, by swimming for spear fishing or net fishing, or at best, they're in a small dugout canoe. So all of these things put you at extreme risk of crocodile attack, even when there aren't a lot of crocodiles around, because we have way more crocodiles here than they do there. They used to have a lot more there, but they've been really knocked back, and they haven't really fully recovered. But the fact of the matter is, even a small recovery, when you have that many people using the waterways, is going to result in a lot of attacks. Sometimes you just have one crocodile in a river, and that's all it takes.
Brendan, and I would imagine, too, that they are experts at hunting. So if they know that people come down and gather at, say, 5 o'clock to bathe in a particular river in a particular part of the world, that the crocodiles know that, you know.
Oh, absolutely. They memorize patterns. They watch patterns. I know I often use one anecdote. Well, it's not an anecdote, it's an actual thing that happened in Sri Lanka about 12 years ago. There was a girl who was bathing in the same river every day, and there was about a 4-meter crocodile that would watch. Well, she didn't know it was watching her, but it would bask on the opposite bank every morning. She didn't think anything of it. And then a few days would go by, and then the crocodile wasn't there. And she went in to bathe, and what she didn't know was it was waiting for her, because it had been watching her day after day after day. And it decided, you know, she's always alone. I'll come down there, I'll wait. It's a high chance of success, and that's what happened. It more often happens when people are bathing alone, because crocodiles know, you know, there's people around. It's a little noisier, and people are more likely to provide resistance. So they're not stupid animals, despite what people may think. They're quite intelligent.
I would have actually guessed that they would have been very intelligent. Is there a train of thought that they're stupid?
Well, it has to go with brain size, but we now know that brain size doesn't mean everything. And we know they are capable of things that we never thought possible. Like, they have memories. Here in the Northern Territory, we have a place you're probably familiar with called Cahill's Crossing. It's an area where crocodiles all line up to catch fish, and people often drive over this causeway, and it's in the news a lot. A lot of people do silly things there. But that causeway has only been there for 50 years. So some of the crocodiles there are older than the causeway. Mm. And it's not instinct. They remember, and they come from different rivers. They come all the way from different river systems when they know that it's going to be a higher tide that's going to go over the barrage. So that kind of memory is well beyond what we would expect from crocodilians. So it's quite impressive.
Is there a concern, too, sometimes with tourists to Australia? Because I guess, you know, if you grow up, or maybe not even tourists from overseas, but tourists from, say, Victoria, where we are and remain, as I touch wood, croc-free. But if you go to a place where there are crocodiles, that you're just not used to watching out for them. You know, you don't believe it's going to be a problem.
That is a concern, but the number up here, the people who are usually attacked are the locals. We've had a few back in 2002, I think it was, Isabel von Jordan from Germany was killed. But most of the time, it's locals because they get complacent. They go to the same place over and over again, and they think, I've never had a problem, and they go a little deeper. They do more and more silly things, and then eventually their number's up. You know, they've done something irresponsible, and they've been attacked. I mean, I like to say that every attack in Australia is preventable, and we can't say that about some of these middle-income countries that are close by, like Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. But in Australia, every attack should be preventable, because it's just a matter of following the safety instructions and not going in the water, because we don't need to go in the water in these. And you don't want to go in these muddy rivers anyway, so I don't understand it, but... So it's quite easy to avoid being attacked by a crocodile in Australia, not so much in some of the other countries.
What's Brendan, what is next for your research?
I have done a lot of work in Papua New Guinea field work, because that place was kind of a big black hole when it came to crocodile attack information, because we didn't know how many people were being attacked, because nothing was getting reported, because there's not really, it's very rural, not a lot of police presence, not a lot of medical presence, so people get killed, they just bury them. So we had to go through many rivers, many villages, asking people to try to figure out the the real magnitude of the situation. And it turned out, unfortunately, it was far worse than we expected. Next up, I'm working on some Indonesian stuff based on data I already have. So I'm not going there, although I do go there a lot just for travel and to look at crocodiles there anyways, because they have a few other species too beyond just, they have saltwater crocodiles too. But yeah, we're going to be writing a lot of papers and then hopefully implementing some mitigation and management strategies that will benefit both humans and crocodiles, because the last thing we want to do is go out there and just shoot all the crocs. We're trying to foster coexistence.
Brandon, what got you into crocodiles?
Well, I think like a lot of kids, I was really interested in dinosaurs when I was a kid. And at the time, this was in the 80s, we weren't aware that, at least as far as I know, it wasn't common knowledge that birds actually are dinosaurs. I just knew they were related to dinosaurs. So crocodiles looked like dinosaurs, at least the ones that we see in movies. And then, you know, when I was a little older, Jurassic Park came out. So stuff like that really got me into it. And then when I got older, I actually started seeing some of the crocodiles in the wild and understanding that they're actually very closely related to birds and all this other stuff. So a lot of really interesting stuff, pulled me in. And then the fact that they're often present in these, in a lot of tropical areas and in some exotic locales. And it just kind of, the intrigue was too much for me, so I had to do it. So.
Thank you. Where are you from, Brandon?
I'm originally from California, but I've spent a lot of time traveling, and I've lived here in Darwin for a little over 3 years now. But I've been coming here since 2006, almost every year.
Great town.
Yeah, I love it here.
Brandon, wonderful. Thank you very much for your work, and thanks for your time today.
Yeah, of course.
Brandon Sidlow is a PhD student studying human saltwater crocodile conflict at Charles Darwin University. But for those who are looking to maybe save a few dollars, listen up to this morning, because we're going to have a chat about body weight training, as in using the weight of your own body to exercise. Jackson Fife is Senior Lecturer of Strength and Conditioning Sciences at Deakin University. Hello, Jackson.
Hi, how you going?
Thank you for your time. I know that you're chomping at the bit to talk about that, but first, your favourite Queen song.
Yeah, look, I'm pretty lucky. I mean, I grew up, my parents were big Queen fans, so, you know, We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions. I'd have to say I really like Radio Gaga, actually.
Radio Gaga?
The Live Aid version.
Okay, yeah, all right. Well, yeah. if you do the right thing during this interview, we may very well be able to play you a little of the Live Aid version of Radio Gaga.
That would be awesome.
Exercise, you know, we could talk for hours about the benefits of exercise, but did I sum that up okay, body weight training? Did I get that right? It's using the weight of your own body to exercise.
Absolutely. So any exercise or movement where we're just, yeah, using our body weight as the resistance, we're not lifting any external weights or loads, things like squats, push-ups, lunges, these kind of things, they're all body weight exercises.
And not just as we get older, but it is a case of use it or lose it with the muscles too, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We tend to lose not just muscle mass, but strength and physical function as we age, and we tend to find that the types of strength and muscle that we lose tends to be the ones that we use the least, you know, as we get older. So definitely stopping doing those daily activities is a big contributor.
And there's the thing too, Jackson, where, people will join a gym, but they just... Then they've got to get changed, get in the car, get there, find the time. It sort of takes a big chunk out of your day. Is there, and not to trash gyms, I mean, gyms are wonderful places for people, but is there a way around that, you know, now where you don't necessarily need to have the membership?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And look, there's many things that get in the way of people being more active regularly. So you mentioned a few there. A lot of people find it hard to get to the gym. It can be expensive. Many people don't like that sort of environment. So you definitely can make really, really good fitness gains at home with little to no equipment, and bodyweight resistance training is certainly one way to do that.
What's a good way to start? So someone listening to this saying, oh, I've sort of been thinking about doing that, and you know, I looked at a couple of YouTube clips, but I can't quite get the hang of it. How do you get people into that?
I would just say start simple and small, and I think this is one big mistake a lot of people make when getting into exercise. They tend to go hard too early, so to speak, which becomes unsustainable. So I'd say, look, just set aside, you know, two or three chunks of time during your week, focus on doing four or five basic simple exercises that you feel like you can do and actually enjoy doing. And then it's really just focusing on being consistent from there and kind of starting small but building gradually.
There is something in that, finding the exercise that actually you don't hate doing. We're not going to say like, but it's one that you don't necessarily hate doing. Because somebody, Jenny in Fitzroy, said how much she hates planks. I mean, yeah. is there you know, you can find a better way, you know what I mean? If you yep. you hate planks, well, you find something else.
Absolutely. And that's the best thing, I think, about resistance training and exercise more generally, is that there's really no mandatory exercises that you have to do. And I say this to people all the time, that if you don't like doing squats or push-ups or whatever it might be, just find something else, something that still works similar muscles, but in a way that you enjoy, because we know that that's one of the biggest predictors of whether someone will stick to exercise is actually how it makes them feel. And many people have that perception that exercise is just something that should make us feel miserable and therefore many people don't like it. But there are ways to adjust it to make it more palatable, for sure.
Good talking to you, Jackson. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
But before you go, we have a treat for you. That's Radio Gaga from Queen for Jackson Five, Senior Lecturer of Strength and Conditioning Sciences at Deakin University.